Welcome to the Wagon Wheel. Jared Kimber here. I'm trying to remember the best way of putting this. It'll be a quicker Wagon Wheel than usual because I've got another podcast with Bayram after this as well. But try and get to as many questions as I can beforehand. Super chats, obviously, you can put them in. I'll probably have to rush through them a little bit today. But if you want to put some super chats in the podcast that we'll do afterwards with Bayram, that might be the best bet. But many other people have already put their questions in via Patreon, which is patreon.com/goodairspodcast. Like Ben, who says, in the future, cricket in the Olympics draws in the sporting funding might of the USA and China as they look for a way to get more medals than each other. How does this change how cricket will look in 30 years' time? I mean, I suppose it depends on just how much it happens. Like, as in, there's a difference between China and the USA investing money and what India, Australia, England, South Africa, Pakistan, whoever else you want to put. Because for them, it's always going to be more than the Olympics. So there's plenty of Olympic sports that have money that China and America are not dominant at, right? Just because it's not something that is taken up. So it needs to be taken up. Either way, we're going towards a franchise model, but you know, it would be huge for Major League Cricket, would probably be the main thing. But I think we're moving towards a franchise model anyway. So what would be interesting is if America, would it be a bit like the Premier League in football, the IPL, where Americans still want to actually go and play in that, even though they have a decent league themselves, I suppose is possible. Ubik says, do you think it's true that spinners play spin bowling better than non-spinners? Not always. I think wicketkeepers have an advantage over most other cricketers. I'm not sure that I believe that spinners do. The only way to look at that would be to look at, I don't know, the top 50 spinners in international cricket, and then check their batting averages versus pace and spin, and see if there's a big difference. Then you also have to look at what the expected rate is, because maybe tail-enders do better against spin anyway. I'm not sure they do, but let's just, you'd have to have some sort of a baseline there. But no, I mean, I was a spinner from a very young age, and I'm much better against spin now than I am against pace. But for most of my life, I was much better against pace. So I don't think being a spinner gave me a huge advantage. MF Jim says, well, Sunil Gavaskar's remarks to Ask Something Insane about India funds their salaries. So they should be quiet about criticizing its overt advantage in this tournament. Well, I haven't heard this one. I saw people talking about it, but I didn't know exactly what it was. I know Nasser and Atherton are very critical on England when it's needed, so they are both being balanced media members. Does this bring out any doubt about the journalistic integrity inside of India? Is it Sunil Gavaskar being Sunil? It's definitely Sunil Gavaskar being Sunil. Or a sign that BCCI has some power over the Indian cohort of journos? It's much harder to be independent, I think, if you work in Indian cricket. So I'll tell you the real story. I will be occasionally contacted by someone in Indian cricket who wants to do a podcast. And I'll be like, okay, well, you know, this is what we need to do if you want us to help you set it up, or, you know, do all the different back-end things. But essentially, I've had Indian people record stuff with me and then delete it because they're afraid of what they've said. Because if they say something that is seen as anti-BCCI, it's not just that they won't get commentary gigs anymore, which they won't. They may not get coaching gigs. It may put other jobs and opportunities involving and stuff. There is a real fear. Now, is that fear justified? I don't know. I don't know if there's anyone who has spoken out and really lost their gigs. So I know there was a whole Harsha thing, but I don't think he was really speaking out. Like, it wasn't like he was saying, oh, there's something wrong with the BCCI. But there is certainly a fear within Indian cricket media that there is a vindictiveness, especially amongst the former players. So, yeah, I do think that's a part of it. There's plenty of negative stuff written about the BCCI in India, though, right? But it's generally kind of more tabloidy, trashy, nonsense, gossipy stuff. There isn't a lot of really clear, great analysis on the BCCI. Cricinfo probably did it better in previous generations, and they've probably backed off it a little bit, partly because, to be fair, the BCCI, I've reached out. I remember when I worked at Cricinfo, and this is a long time ago, they sort of reached out to say, Jared's continually saying stuff about us, right? And it didn't affect my career or anything. But if I was in India, the pressure might have been put on me in a different way than it was in my way. And also, I think Cricinfo knew that if they tried to stop me, I probably would have gone the other direction and would cause them more problems. So I never had that fear. But the commentary thing is very interesting. The whole thing about India paying their salaries, though, just on a separate thing, it's funny. I get told this all the time. Oh, India pays your salary, or you make all your money from India. I still make more money from cricket in England than I do from cricket in India. It's about, it's probably closer to 50-50 than it's ever been. Cricinfo was a bit different, actually. Obviously, I got paid. Well, I got paid out of the States, but that was, I would say that is mostly, that was probably a much bigger percentage of Indians in that case when I worked for Cricinfo. But since going freelance, I haven't really made much money from India outside of, you know, YouTube stuff and Substack, but that isn't the major part of my income. So there is this whole thing of like, there actually, you can make good money in England and you actually can make good money in Australia. The rest of the world's probably more, it's more correct. But realistically, if you're in the media, and Sanal Gavaskar is someone who has said what he thinks through the majority of his career. It's a bit of a shame that he thinks other people can't say things anymore, right? Like, we all know that India, no one doesn't think that India hasn't had a ridiculously good run in this world, in this Champions Trophy, right? You should be allowed to say that. William says, what is up with teams bowling, part-time bowlers, love Shane Livingston at the death in ODIs? It's mostly on wickets where they thought they would be effective. It's also partly down to, I think England had some injuries in their case. And with Labuschagne, it was down to the pitch. And, you know, neither of those teams also have good death bowls. I don't think it's something that's going to happen all the time. It's just, you know, something that we've seen a little bit more recently. Manan says, what are some things that professional international cricketers do that club cricketers could learn from? Simple things that would improve their game. Oh, the simplest thing, and I remember being told this by Mitch McClenaghan and Callum McLeod. So my first two major jobs, right, where they were just like, it's basically club cricket, but we're used to losing and failing because we lose and fail on a much bigger level than anyone does at the in amateur cricket. If you play once a week in amateur cricket and you fail 2 weeks in a row, that is 3 weeks of failure, right? Like, it's a long period of time between you making runs if you're a batter or a bowler or whatever that may be. So they're much better at keeping level and understanding all those sorts of things. Everything else they do is the supernatural stuff that wouldn't really help amateurs. But that's the most important thing. I think that's what I've been trying to teach. You know, Zachariah's not as interested in sport, but even Zachariah can get a little bit down. But Ezekiel just gets so high or so low. And I'm like, one day you're going to fail and one day you're going to be good. You need to understand how to accept both. And that's the thing that amateurs really struggle with. PJ says, what stats would you like to see added to a traditional stats page on Cricinfo? This is a very long question. I don't know if Cricinfo needs to add that many extra stats. Like, I think a casual fan just wants to see roughly what's there. I'm trying to think if there's anything specific. No, because I think there should just be advanced stats. And I don't think they necessarily need to be on Cricinfo. Obviously, you know, I've been part of a business trying to get that up for a little while now. And a couple of times I've had funding and it's fallen through. And I've talked to the basketball reference people and it's fallen through. But I really think it needs to be a site separate to Cricinfo rather than anything else. As far as what would be the best metric to measure clutch, there isn't one. NF Jim says, with AFL season starting in Australia in March, don't ask why, money. will you be keeping up with it at all? I think when I got back into basketball, as full on as I have, I found it really hard to keep up with basketball and AFL at the same time. So I generally know probably the top 15 players for Collingwood. But outside of that, I don't know many of the fringe players. Like, my dad will say, oh, you know, so-and-so's been injured and this guy's coming up. I'm like, I have no idea who that guy is. I don't watch as much football as I used to. I probably, in the old day, when I first started being a writer, you know, in the UK and everything, and I had access, I'd probably watch a couple of games a week. And I watch a lot of footy. Like, you know, we would try and go to 3 and 4 games a week when I was, you know, with me and my mates. So it's gone from that to probably a couple of games a week, and now it's mostly Collingwood games. So if a Collingwood game's on in a good time zone, I'll watch it. And Collingwood play a lot of night games, but I don't follow it all that closely anymore. Roger says, which IPL teams, current or past, would have made the best ODI teams? To clarify, if you pick the 2013 Mumbai, you don't get to have peak Ponting and Tendulkar. You get them. Oh, okay. Is that not the RCB, the first ever RCB side? I suppose if you had Rohit, Hardik, Bumrah, Pollard, QDK, who else am I missing on? There would be a good Mumbai side in there. Trying to think of some of the Sunrisers sides. I suppose Chennai would have had some good teams, wouldn't they, as well, I would have thought, over the time. Trying to think what period of Chennai would be best. Do you have a Raidu, Dhoni, Jadeja? I'm missing someone. Reina, crossover, and there would be others as well. But there must be a crossover period in there. Nadika says, could Sobers fielding have made it onto the second skill in cricket picks? Bayram and Estelle's 95s notwithstanding. Where would you rank it above either his – would you rank it above his spin bowling or his pace bowling? Certainly not above his pace bowling, only because I think he was a very good pace bowler. Spin bowling, probably he was a better fielder. The thing with Sobers is that I think he would have been – he was probably the first great outfielder that wasn't like a specialist fielder, because there were some other guys as well, right? But he's probably the first great outfielder. I don't know if he was a great slip fielder. I think he was a very, very good slip fielder. But I'm not – so I actually think his worth as a fielder went down when they put him in the slips. Now, of course, they had to, because he probably still was a low-end great slip fielder. But I don't think he was up in that sort of top five or top ten of all time, based purely on stories. Whereas as an outfielder, the stories are incredible, and you would have to say that certainly there weren't many better outfielders at his time. Like, you know, he was on a completely different level. So I think you could make that claim. But he could also say that it's his fourth skill or his third skill. That's how many skills he had. Nicholas says, best player with a match factor below one or worst player with a match factor above one that you've found? I know Varun has obviously made the match factor. I haven't done a lot of trawling through it at the moment, Nicholas. You know, I really like match factor, but it's funny that some people got really upset. There was a guy on Twitter who got really upset. He said it was a dark day for cricket writing because we use match factor. I kind of think match factor is one of about 10 or 12 skills, things you look up when you're looking up if someone's good or not. Unfortunately, because it's a new thing, it's kind of being, you know, obsessed over by some people. But yeah, I haven't really gone through anything particular. I know for the book, I thought Cullinan's record was really interesting. And I want to say Peter May was another one. Cullinan and Peter May were two guys that probably their raw stats don't pop, but their overall stats go very good. But yeah, I just haven't gone through it enough, Nicholas. It's a good question. But PGA says, India 8-0 against Pakistan in 50 over World Cups and 6-1 against Pakistan in T20 World Cups. Is it fair to compare this rivalry to the Ashes between 89-03? Where Australia won 8 series in a row. Yeah, I mean, there isn't a single Pakistani player, as they are currently playing, that would get in an Indian squad, let alone a team. So I suppose Alex Stewart would have played for Australia if they didn't want a frontline wicketkeeper. Maybe Goffey or Caddick would have got in at times in the 90s. And Graham Thorpe was probably good enough to get a couple of tests for Australia, whether he would have just because of the depth of batting that they had at that stage, especially in his positions. But he was certainly good enough to play, but whether he would have slipped in. So, yeah, very similar. Panda Cyborg says, I recently heard that Kyle Mills was the highest wicket-taker in Champions League history, which somehow seems entirely fitting for this tournament. It did get me wondering, though, before T20 dominated the global landscape, who's the best white ball bowler who never really made it in tests? Nathan Bracken is a very good one. Would you say Agarkar? Would he be potentially one that you would have up there? Brad Hogg comes to mind. There's probably a couple of Australian spinners. I don't know what Peter Taylor's record was in one day cricket, but he might be another one. I'm trying to think of some other like white ball specialist. Depends on how you look at Malinga. He doesn't have a bad test record, but I don't know. Would he be another one that you would have up there? Bowlers. Yeah, those are the ones that come to mind. Carlos was a very good player, by the way. And probably bowled in the mostly during the batting era, I would have thought. Ben says, why did leg byes go into a scoring black hole and aren't attributed to any individual player. The bowler's delivered the ball in a place that has led to the runs, and the ball has hit the batter. So both players have been involved. Yeah, it's an interesting one. I kind of understand why they're not, and I get so many questions about leg bias, because should the bowler get it for beating, like, if you've bowled an off cutter that has come back and beats inside part of the bat, hits the thigh pad, and the ball rolls out past the wicketkeeper, you've beaten the batter, and it's just kind of through a fluke that happens. But you also get leg bias where you don't. I actually think, I don't know, and I don't know exactly how to do this, but I do think one day there will be, we might have a more errors and unforced errors. Because I don't think leg bias is the big problem here, Ben, but I do think overthrows is a really interesting one, right? Like, I think there are better ways to do what we've done in cricket, but I completely understand why we are where we are.
As a cricket journalist, I would travel up to 200 days a year, and I loved every part of it, except for one, this little evil pin here, because I needed this to change my SIM card. And when you travel in cricket, you're quite often going from country to country. Don't get me started on how much this would annoy me in the West Indies, but even going from New Zealand to Australia, this pin was the worst. Well, with the Sally eSIM, they sort all of that out for you. They have an eSIM app that you install once, it's cheap, and it works in more than 160 countries around the world. No more turning up at an airport and lining up for a local SIM, trying to give over your passport and your details, and you just want to get in a taxi and go where you're going. No, Sally make it so much easier. You just download the app before you travel and you decide what kind of plan you actually need. Oh, and if you do that with our code, GOODAREAS, all one word, you get an exclusive 15% discount on Sally eSIM data plans. So go right now and download the Sally app and use the code GOODAREAS, all one word, at checkout and travel like a pro with Sally.
Rob says, if the white ball is so shit, what is stopping the pink ball being adopted for T20 and ODIs? Is it cricket's usual lack of leadership, or are there technical issues like increased swing and visibility? I think there is a bit of an issue that people think it might favour bowlers too much. But I think I go with your first one, Rob. I think cricket is run poorly. I don't understand why it hasn't been trialled. I'm a big fan of the pink ball, as in, I think it's better than the white one. Like, obviously, neither of them are anywhere near the red one. But I think the pink ball, like, this is what I don't understand. So many people bitching and moaning about the two balls. Where are those people going, well, a pink ball can last 50 overs? So for me, you would do it. Would you have to change some of the I don't know if that's causing a problem. And I don't know, but I'm just saying, would you have to change? I've always found the pink ball the easiest to see. Of all the different colored cricket balls I've ever used, I find the pink far easiest to see. So I certainly go with that. MF Jim says, should India have been forced to play across at least two venues that have a bit of difference, say between Dubai and Abu Dhabi or Saudi Arabia? So we talked about this on a previous podcast. Like, you're still going to get – so it's still going to favour them. Like, even if they played in Sri Lanka or Sharjah or – am I missing somewhere else? Abu Dhabi, right? Oman. You're still going to get roughly the same amount of wickets. But the ICC is cheap. It is what it costs the ICC money. The same reason we only have 15 players in the squad. It's not because we think that's the optimal squad. People at the ICC have suggested more. It's going to cost them a lot more money. They would never have done this. But yeah, you know, if you were trying to make it fair, I suppose you would do this. But there are so many times that this is obviously massively favoured India. And I've said that for ages. And I said it from the start. Have a look how many times schedules favour other teams. No one says shit. We have come to a point now where everything's become so anti the BCCI, and I get it, right? Like, I understand. But at a certain point, it's like, what about other teams? Like, we had Sri Lanka in the last World Cup staying too far away from the ground. And when they moaned about it, people were like, oh, and it's like, no, that's a real thing. I've worked with cricket teams. It's a real thing when you have to do that. It affects everything that you do, right? And other teams are staying closer to the hotels. No one was saying that they were staying closer and that was, do you know what I mean? But if it's India, so I do think that's an issue. But yeah, in a perfect world, MF Jim, we would do that. In a perfect world, nothing that happens in cricket would happen. Panda Sidebook says, you finished your book of the 50 greatest batters and have been talking about maybe doing one on bowlers, correct? I was wondering if it's possible to do something similar for captaincy. Is there any objective way to measure captaincy? Not historically. I do think in the future, using betting markets or win predictors or whatever you want to do, you could work out what percentage of a time a team should win a game. So I think they do this in Coach of the Year award in the NBA. And I don't know if any other sports do it, but I'm pretty sure they do this in Coach of the Year award. One of the things they look at is what the betting market suggests the amount of wins is going to be, and then whether the team went higher or lower. It becomes a little bit tricky over time because eventually the captain kind of makes the players perform better than they should. But certainly towards the start of, you know, in the first couple of years, I think it can give you a good idea. But no, I'll probably never do that book on captaincy. PJ says, is there a way to take old footage and run it through some sort of software that would give you some sort of our modern luxuries, such as Hotspot, pitch maps? No. So the big thing at the moment is they're trying to – I know there's a bunch of people doing this at the moment – trying to work out if you can put Hawkeye just on top of normal footage so that they can make money from betting. And I know about four or five different organizations doing this at the moment because it's a potentially – I don't know if it's a $1 billion idea, but it's a multi-million dollar idea if you can work out, because you can bet against the markets knowing information, but no one's been able to do it. No. PJ says, the Rebel test hosted by South Africa during isolation, just how seriously did the visitors take those tours? Did they regard it as a holiday in the sun? Yeah, it was kind of a bit of both, PJ. I think, you know, and this depends on the cricketers, right? They knew it wasn't going to go against their normal records. So a lot of the senior players weren't taking it massively seriously. I think there were certainly younger players who were trying to, you know, prove their worth and everything. But there's no doubt that South Africans took it a lot more seriously than anyone else did. I've never heard anything that suggests that wasn't the case. Bloody says, until the 1950s, 60s, it was common in the UK for children to play games in the street, such as cricket or football. You've mentioned before the 1966 Football World Cup, when cements football as England's number one sport. But maybe the death of street games uniquely detriments the popularity of cricket? I don't know. There's a lot of places in the UK. There's a lot of parks in the UK. There's a lot of greenery in the UK. There's a lot of concrete places where you could go and play cricket that I've never seen anyone playing cricket in. I think if the passion is there, Bloody, people will play cricket in those places. Jane says, we've had a number of comments on how the IPL has outgrown the auction and should be done away with. Clearly, it's in place to placate the owners of poorly performing teams without which they would not participate. Really? Because I would have thought it's the opposite. If I'm a poorly placed team, I'd rather have a draft system so that I get higher draft picks in the following year. If we do away with the auction, what system would you propose? I've done this heaps of times, Jane. I would have a new player draft, an experienced player draft, and then once you've done over 6 or 8 years or so many games, free agency. That's what I would be doing. Ruja says, why can't Pakistan develop more dynamic ODI batters? Given the flat pitches in internationals, you would think that they would have had more hitters and fast scorers. Yeah, I think this is a really interesting one because it makes sense that Bangladesh play the way they do. It doesn't really make sense that Pakistan do. But if you go through their history, they really haven't had a lot of fast scorers. So Inzi and Javed Miandad both had it within them. But actually, I think if you look at their overall numbers, they're not particularly fast scorers for their era. Obviously, Shahid Afridi, if we take him aside, but not a specialist batter. And Wasim Akram, not a specialist batter. I don't think they've ever had anyone. So that suggests to me that it's probably more to do with the conditions. Less to do with the conditions, because I agree with you, the conditions should help that, but more to do with the mindset and the coaching and the upbringing and how they think about batting would be my guess. I find it really fascinating. There's a couple of little quirks like that in cricket, and I think that's one of the more interesting ones. Thatsbro says, is Clive Lloyd underrated as an ODI batter because he was only the third best in his team behind Viv and Greenwich? One of the issues that happened, and we talked about this, if you go to our video, Sanchmo, you'll see that we talked about this a little bit in it, is that he actually didn't play a lot of ODI cricket. So he plays majority of cricket in the 70s. There really isn't a lot of ODIs in the 70s. Packer is the one that plays all the ODIs. And I remember looking at this for the Packer documentary on Channel 9, and I can't remember the numbers, but Packer was playing more ODIs in Australia than were played in the 75 and 79 World Cup. So by the time Clive Lloyd starts playing a lot of ODI cricket, he's probably past his prime. And as you said, Greenwich and you can throw Haynes in there as well. There's not as much of a crossover, but Haynes was certainly around at times as well. I think that all plays a part But I think if you have, like, Greenidge isn't thought of as a great ODI player, again, probably because he didn't play a lot in the 70s. But Lloyd and Greenidge were both great ODI players well before a lot of other people worked out what to do. But I think Viv does suck up a little of the oxygen there. PJ says, release, resign, or retain, reskill the IPL version of Fuck, Marry, Kill. Brevis, Stubbs, Ferreira. Release, Donovan, Ferreira. Retrain, reskill, Dylan Brevis, and resign, Stubbs. Yeah. PJ says, rank the following cool Caribbean cricketers in order of swagger. Viv, Gale, Richardson, Hooper, Bravo. Not really a swagger dude, PJ. I don't know. Viv is at number one. Bravo's probably... Richardson might be last. I don't know if I have strong views on the guys in the middle. Thatchbro says, what would have happened to Test cricket if TV money had been evenly distributed across all the full members during the last 30 years? Would we still effectively have two Test tiers? Yeah, I think we'd still have two Test tiers. I think that makes sense. I just think we'd have stronger teams all around the world. The product would be better and we'd be making more money off it. But I think tiers are inevitable once you actually allow more than eight teams to play in it. PJ says, if cricket had a combine like the NFL, what events would there be and what would they test for? So Major League Cricket had a combine. For those of you who don't know, it's kind of like you send all your best prospects there and they're tested on different skills. And I was supposed to be involved with the Major League one and it didn't quite work out the way that they or I wanted it to be. But I was really interested in it. I think running with pads on is something I'd be really interested in. Range hitting, like what length that you can range hit. Obviously bowling speed, revolutions on the ball would be another one. And there'd probably be a bunch of fielding ones as well. Throwing speed, throwing accuracy, those sorts of things. James says, law 17.8 allows a bowler to complete an over that another bowler started. Should the original bowler become incapacitated or suspended? But there's no defined test for incapacitation. Is there anything to stop a fielding captain using this strategically in a death over that's not gone to plan? I think we've seen it before. So, no. This is why subs are really, really tricky in cricket. Because every fast bowler you could sub out at any single stage at any point. So, yes, you could definitely do this. I think we've seen bowlers feign injury. Generally, it's when you have a non-specialist bowler and something's going wrong, cramps, back pain, what it may be. But I've seen it before. But yeah, incapacitated is doing a lot of work there. Rob says, as great as ABD was, could he also be the player who missed out on his potential? Or did he retire at his peak and avoid the late career decline? No, I don't think he missed his late career decline based on what we saw of him in IPL and T20. I don't think he had any decline. I think you could argue that AB de Villiers was even better than we saw. So I talked to him for the book and you can see the podcast. Actually, the podcast is up. Listen to what he says at one stage. He basically said that at times he felt like he could turn any fast bowler into the world into someone throwing underarms to him. I just don't know if I've ever, Barry Richards, Viv Richards might have said something similar. Listen to the way Virat talks about him is one of my favorite things. Like, it's really interesting. So many Virat fans will go on and on about how great Virat is. Virat goes on and on about how great AB is. In the same way, Rahul Dravid about Ricky Ponting is another great one. Kumar Sangakkara is another, does it about Brian Lara. Like, there are levels, right? And I think AB de Villiers is right up at the top. I've seen enough of Barry Richards to know how good he was, but obviously we didn't see him in Asia and regularly tested, but we saw him for a couple of years and then we saw him in World Series cricket. Like, we know how good he was. And I don't think we ever saw him at his absolute best because, and I think we're probably the same with AB de Villiers is how I feel. That there was probably more things to unlock that he didn't actually unlock, which is a bit of a shame, but he's still really good. Sandeep says, can you please talk about the current adoption of synthetic pitches and how they wear during the course of the match and tournament compared to real ones? So we don't have synthetic pitches, Sandeep. We have hybrid pitches, which is a little bit of synthetic and a little bit of natural. It's basically like sewing. I've done a video on it, I think, Sandeep, that you should be able to find. about hybrid pitches. If you Google my name and that, you'll be able to find it on the main channel. And I think me and Bayram actually talked about it on this channel as well. They're a little bit tricky because they're a little bit two-paced. Because if the ball hits the thread, it sort of zips through. And if it hits the pitch, it stops. And sometimes it's the opposite as well, I've been told. But either way, the ball doesn't quite come off at the same pace all the time, which is the big issue that you're always going to have with a hybrid wicket. But essentially what it allows is it stops the wicket from getting tired. It stops from what's been happening in Dubai, right? Where these wickets have just been getting more and more tired. And that's why they will eventually take over. They're much better for the environment. They're much better for TV. But yeah, if you want to have a look, there's a big long video I've done on it. But essentially it's like sewing the wicket together and keeping it together and fresher. And they recover better and they can be used more. But we still had issues with them. They're nowhere near perfect. They're probably like the pink ball if you're looking for a comp.
The scores were level. They just needed a conversation. Instead, the only time they met up was at the same end, and Australia would go on to win that World Cup. In HitWicket, you've got those game-changing special abilities at your fingertips. Need to accelerate the scoring? Bang! Activate 2x, and suddenly every boundary is worth double. That's right, a 6 becomes a 12. The opposition won't know what hit them. Or maybe you need to put the brakes on a high-scoring power play. No problem. Unleash the heck, and watch the batter struggle to even score a single run. In fact, they might even end up going backwards. It's absolute chaos. Look at the King of Spin, for example. But there's more to it than just flashy special moves. Every player has their own unique passive traits that add another layer of strategy. Gilly, for example, he's a seam hunter, a nightmare for any pace bowler. And Beefy, well, he's got a golden arm. The longer a partnership lasts, the more dangerous he becomes. HitWicket challenges you to think like a true captain. You've got to analyze your players, understand their strengths and weaknesses, and then use those abilities and traits to outwit your opponent. It is a real test of your cricketing brain. Now, if you excuse me, I've got a strategy to revise.
Person says, my apologies if this has been asked before. Everything's been asked before, Person. What if the USA got to be a founding member in the ICC in 1909? Well, that would have been impossible, because it was the Imperial Cricket Conference. I have my own guesses, but I want to keep it open-ended and not corrupt you by yanksplaining cricket alt history to you. Look, cricket by 1909 was already struggling in America. That's kind of, maybe that keeps it around a little bit more relevant. But by that stage, the newspapers have turned to baseball. America, it's America's pastime. You've got Babe Ruth coming through and everything else. And Barton King is probably on his decline. I think they would have struggled if they were one of the three. I wonder where they would have been compared to South Africa, which is a very interesting take. But if they're not competitive against South Africa, they would have struggled. It also probably depends on how good Canada was at that point, because they're going to have to play Canada quite a lot. But by that point, I think that was I think they might have been less powerful. I suppose if they had a reason to play and go on, things would have changed a little bit going forward, but I don't, but there's every chance that they kind of just drop off naturally as well. So it could have been entirely different and the whole sport could have been different, or it actually could have been roughly the same. And I don't know which direction that would have gone in. MF Jim says, what name does a player decide to use on the back of their shirts? I know Akshar Patel uses Akshar on the back of his shirt, but most Indian players use what would be their second name to Westerners. Yeah, it just depends on whatever name that player goes by. You can have, in some cases, players have had nicknames before as well, especially in franchise cricket. But yeah, it's the name that is your common, I think there's a term for this that other people might know better than me, but it's the common usage name. So that can be a second name or a first name. Or a sometimes it's it might be your third or fourth name, right? Like it depends on how it works. Within the naming structure, but it's your common usage name that you use. So Washington would always be Washington and not Sundar, right? Because he is Washington. And so you get that with a lot of the Islamic players as well, right? Their name is not, the name that they are known by might not be the name that is their last name. And sometimes it is, right? So there's all these different naming conventions. But, yeah, it's you. I think you get to pick it. But in international cricket, I don't think – well, for World Cups and stuff, you don't get to pick nicknames. But you do get to pick the name that you want to be known by. I think that's a fair and normal thing for people to do. Will says, if the Champions Trophy must endure, surely the time has come for it to be an elite T Twenty competition. Yeah, I mean, I've been saying that for ages. It was almost, this one was almost a T Twenty competition. Yes, but I if the Champions Trophy sticks around, well, it will definitely be a T20 competition, I would assume, going into the future. Person says, in a previous WAG World, you discussed the differences between Australia's Shield competition for the sake of the national team versus England's county system, which exists for its own sake. Where does India's domestic system fit into this dichotomy? Yeah, India, almost everywhere else in the world outside of England, the national team is always and always has been more important. That is not, it's just not the case for England because the county system is what built international cricket. Right. Whereas that's not the case with every other format of the game. Every other country, I should say. PJ says, which team of peak 90s dibbly dobblers are you backing to win a penalty shootout style bowler? Ronnie Irani, Mark Elam, Adam Holyoake versus Chris Harris, Gavin Larson, Nathan Arthur. I'll go with the second one. So, PJ. PJ again. With regards to women's league question, oh, that might be later. I don't know if anyone has asked that yet. How viable and feasible would a structured men's A-team league be? We missed it, PJ. I first wrote about this in 2007, but that is what the major team should be doing. It's really hard now to even get players to commit to A-team cricket because they've got franchise opportunities available to them. We had a chance of doing this a long time ago, and it should have been done. I can't imagine it's ever going to be done now. Josh says, who would you rather face in the Champions Trophy semi-final, Australia or South Africa? Australia? PJ says, with the ship having long left the harbour and trying to organise a men's game, how viable and feasible would it be for the ICC to run elite women's cricket along the lines of the women's Ashes? The format of one... If I was a... And I don't know who the person is that does this. It's probably Mel Jones, because Mel Jones does everything. But if I was a person with a lot of power within women's cricket at the moment, I would be trying to secede. I would be leaving the men's game and running the women's game now. There's enough money. There's enough interest. It's just so tacked on to the men's game. And don't get me wrong. Me and Raf Nicholson would probably agree and disagree on these points. But I would probably say that the period that it came back to the men's game has probably helped it get to the point where it is. And I don't think it was going to do that on its own. But now I'd be like, it needs to go on its own. So yes, I'm not sure I would go with the system you've come up with, just because I'm not a huge fan of that system on my own. But I would go it alone and come up with a system that works for women's cricket going forward. That's better than the men's system, because the problem is the women are now copying a men's system that already doesn't work and it's never worked. PJ says, if you're coaching your kids to play cricket from scratch today, well, I kind of am, in a T20 and T10 future, how would you turn them into? Would you rather turn them into right-hand batters who bowl slow left-armers or left-handed batters who bowl right-arm leg spin? There's always an advantage of being a left-hander. So I made all of my kids bat left-handed. My daughter, she will be learning how to bat left-handed as well. Turned out one of my kids was left-handed. So kind of backfired. But I think we stand on the wrong side of the bat. But also, there's fewer left-handers, so left-handers are always more important, I think, coming through. You can't really do it with bowling. With bowling, I think it's just your dominant arm. I tried it quite a bit with my kids, and it didn't seem to take. So, I probably wouldn't worry about that. But, yeah, left-hand batters for sure, and bowling is just whatever comes natural to them with the bowling. Will says, if we've missed the window to turn ODI cricket into 40 overs a side, would it be better to go the other way and go back to 60 overs? There's just no way you can get more. I don't think you can get enough good modern cricketers who have been willing to bowl that many overs in a day. They don't like bowling 10 overs well. So I don't think that is going to work the way that we would like it to work. What I would say is this, again, a bit like women's cricket, there's a lot of people who've grown up with ODI cricket who absolutely love it, who are now 40, 45, 50, 55, who are very rich. ODI cricket should succeed as well. Succeed? Did I say succeed before? Yeah, I'm not sure what I said. But secede. It should leave. And if you could do that, I'm not sure you'd go 60 overs well, but you'd probably do a bunch of different things. That I'd be much more interested in. MF Jim says, a passionate defense of the WACA. Any ground with a hill cannot be considered bad. you can't sit on the hill. It's too hot. Watching cricket, I grew up at the MCG, so hills don't really mean much to me. It's just an uncomfortable way to sit for 7 hours. I remember going to Centurion and sitting on the hill there. And I spent the entire day just shifting. It just wasn't comfy to me. So I'm not that for that. Corbin Minima said he used to have to put his laptop in a cool room to prevent it from overheating. I started that. I was the person who first took his laptop at the Wacka and put it into the fridge. And then everyone copied it, and it was on the front page or the back page of the English newspapers and everything, right? If you do not have a ground that has facilities that can keep laptops cool, that's not what happens in extreme heat. That was because they didn't have press facilities, MF Gym, that were adequate for a summer game in a summer country. I've been to hotter places than Perth, right? I've been to Dubai bunches of times. My laptops never stopped working in Dubai. Specifically, the issue was the way that they had I can't even get into it. They had the worst press facilities. It was a tiny little box where you had to fight with other people to go to the toilet. Everything about the Wacka was unprofessional. The staff were as rude as I've ever had anywhere. Lots of people moan about the Lord's staff, right? I've had so many run-ins with the Wacka staff where they've just been absolute dicks. The facilities were not acceptable for an international ground, certainly not for one in Australia. It was not fit for purpose to hold international cricket. I love the pitch. I've got no problem with Western Australia as a whole. I haven't been to the new stadium, so it could be fantastic, could be shit house, I don't know. I love the Wacka pitch. But that ground was utter ass. And it had been allowed to be ass because everyone there wanted a new ground. You get what you sow, mate. PJ says, if Jofra Archer never plays for England again, what will his legacy be like and how will he be remembered? Key role in the 2019 win, but he's going to end up as a bit of a what if. Yeah, he'll be a what if, I think. He's not got a great record in test matches at the moment. If he never played for England again now, and I don't think that's likely, by the way, I think what it will be is he'll be seen as, oh, you had to be there. I'm trying to think of another player like him. Because Shane Bond, we never got to see Shane Bond, this version of Shane Bond. We only ever saw Shane Bond look awesome. So Shane Bond at least has people going, oh, you have no idea. Whereas with Jofra, it'd be like, oh, you had no idea. But actually, then when he came back, he wasn't always that good. So I don't know is the answer. Probably his legacy is not defined by England from here on in. It's probably by whether he comes back to his best in franchise cricket. PJ says, with the ship having, well, oh, no, we've already done this one. Yeah. Will says, I enjoyed your talk sport discussion about what cricket would be without India as its financial powerhouse. I think the one thing you probably underestimate is the extent at which English cricket becomes the financial powerhouse, fueled by higher ticket prices at grounds and Sky's focus on cricket as a way to get middle-class people to subscribe. No, I think, Will, you're overestimating. That's what cricket was like beforehand. And England cricket didn't really make that much money to shift anything. Right. England wouldn't suddenly become India if India didn't exist, Will, because they were around for ages and Australia had almost as much power as England at times with a fraction of the money. The main issue with England is always going to be that the vast majority of the country don't follow cricket. And so when something happens in Australian cricket, like Sandpapergate, the Australian Prime Minister is all over it, right? It's like the biggest thing ever. Outside of Theresa May, and even then she wasn't that much into it, but outside of Theresa May, I'm not saying there aren't cricket fans or prime ministers. Obviously, John Major has written cricket books, but I don't think they would bring it up all that much unless they're bringing it up in that kind of Theresa May way of, oh, boycott was great. I love boycott type of thing. So you're comparing that to countries like Pakistan and India and Sri Lanka and Bangladesh and even Australia where there is political clout. Like John Howard almost ran the ICC, right? So there's money in England, but I've seen the numbers, mate. Put it this way. England cricket didn't have a lot of money a couple of years ago. I think it has a little bit more now that it's done this sale. But there's a lot of hand-to-mouth in England, right? And that's got nothing to do with India having more money than them. There really isn't that much money in English cricket. I can absolutely promise you that. I think you're massively overestimating how much power England would have. When they had the power of being the colonial masters and way more money than Australia did, right? The second best nation. They still had to share their power a little bit, right? Now, no one cares a shit that they were the colonial masters anymore. And Australia makes a decent chunk of money behind them. I just don't think that would be as big a deal. Anyway, I'm off. Please tell me. Oh, of course, they're super chats. I'll get to them as quickly as I can. Genius Genie says, I started watching the NBA and the Lakers suddenly go to becoming a second seed. Denver probably still better, but I'm the positive jinx. Nuggets just went on a road trip, and to be fair, they played some good teams in that. I would still probably assume that the Nuggets will end up in the second seed, but they could be third. I'm not sure the seeding matters as much to them, whereas I think the Lakers at the moment, they're probably more interested in that. So I think the Lakers won 8 out of 9. Not that long before that, the Nuggets won 9 or 10 in a row. Like, you get these surges in the NBA a lot more than in other sports. Marintha says, is a batting trigger movement being coached from an early age now more than it was in the mid-2000s? The last time I was active coaching via my state side, or is it something specific about India coach in the 2000s versus now? I think trigger movements always existed, but because we were bound beforehand by the MCC coaching manual and they weren't really a part of that, mate, that it wasn't really, it was something that you either did naturally or you didn't do. So the two things that I think have come in most are trigger movements and the back left being up, right? Or unweighted bat, I think they call it now, right? Those always existed. There were people who always did those two things, right? But they would never coach. And you go back to all the old coaching manuals, they're almost never mentioned, right? Or they're mentioned really negatively. As you get players coming through that just naturally have this way, I think it just moves on within itself. Genius says, if we start seeing international T10s officially being played, which nations are best suited to immediately do well? And what would an India 2007 kind of surprise look like at T10? I don't know. I mean, India, Australia, and South Africa are the three teams that are probably best suited to that. There really isn't like a powerhouse. Like if you think of the smaller teams, most of them bat quite slow. Might be interesting with Sri Lanka. I reckon Scotland is another interesting, like a lower level team that might be helped by that. But they're real, and the reason I go with Scotland is because they have genuine hitters, right? That can really score quickly. Not that many other teams really have those kinds of players available to them. So I'm not sure how the T10 league would help a lot of those other sides. Maybe the West Indies again, but I'm just guessing there. Yeah, but probably the West Indies. It's almost always the West Indies, right? All right, that is me done. Thank you very much to everyone. If you're listening to this podcast, it'll be up later in the week. But what I really meant to say was, if you came on the end of the YouTube and you want to listen to it as an audio podcast, this will be delayed a little bit just because we've got some Champions Trophy stuff to do. But thank you to everyone. Remember to hop over to goodareas.co. We've been putting writing up almost every day during the Champions Trophy. We'll probably be going back to about 2 articles a week after that. But please go over and subscribe there on Substack. It's free to subscribe. You don't get access to all the articles. But if there's anything that we've been talking about on one of these shows or on the main channel, that's the best place to go and find the individual details when you need them. Anyway, that's it from me. I'll be seeing you in like 2 minutes time, probably, because Bayram will want to do another podcast. That's not actually a joke either.
Thank you for listening. This podcast has an ad-free version via Patreon, where there are also many other extras as well, including a Discord channel where you can chat to me directly. There is a link to the Patreon in the show notes. We are an independent podcast, so support us any way you can. Maybe give us a review, subscribe, or share on social media. All of these things help us. And when it comes to podcasts, word of mouth is always the best way of making it grow. If we had a guest on, chances are their socials are in the show notes. Please support everyone who comes on this show. I am Jared Kimber, and this is my network. But we also have hosts and co-hosts like Bayram Kazi and Estelle Vassadevan. This network is overseen by Nick McCorriston, and each episode is produced by Ishit Kaburka at Sound Potion Studio. Mukunda Bandredi, or Muku as most people will know, is the head of our YouTube channels, and he also helps out with so many other things like the podcast recordings. And there's so many other people we could thank here, but I just want to thank all the listeners and all the people who help behind the scenes that make this podcast work. If you make any content, Minbo Pro is the tool for you. Take your long format content and cut it and slice it for social media. This AI-inspired weapon will turn your one piece of work into so many clips. Try Minbo.pro now.